Access number 27783, Mr. Doug Radcliffe, Reel 7. Now, we got to the point, you were at 1656 Heavy Conversion Unit at Lindholm, training with flight lieutenant Cochrane. And then, basically, while you're there, the war comes to an end. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
What, firstly, in Europe, and then in Japan, how do you react to V-Day and, you know, the end of the war in Europe?
Well, relief, because we were training for Tiger Force, which was an unknown quantity. Here you're going to fight the Japanese.
So tell me what the role would be with Tiger Force. Tell me, in what way were you training for?
We were training for bombers, heavy bombers, to go out and attack Japan. And you were also being lectured about the different type of warfare that we would expect to be engaged in.
Now, what were they telling you?
Well, we were getting lectures by people who had flown over the Pacific area. We were being lectured by people on survival, jungle survival. You can imagine the depth of feeling with these chaps who'd been flying over Europe to suddenly find they're going to be flying over nothing but jungle and totally different warfare. So there was a bit of concern, and the marvellous feeling when the war ended.
That's the Japan surrender. How did you feel? I mean,
marvellous. That was a feeling. Remember, I think we were called into, I think it was either one of the flights where I think the CO came round and said, you know, it's over and so and so. However, you know, we want you to still on the discipline of the RAF. No chance of leaving the camp tonight, not much. There wasn't everybody charged out, got in their vehicles and drove down to London. And
were there any big celebrations?
Well, I ended up with Cochrane in his car. I've already told you that he had a car outside Cambridge Circus, and I think a lot of students lifted his car over the bollards onto the pavement. And I remember showgirls looking out of the theatre at Cambridge Circus, sort of waving and shouting. The place was thronging. I said cheerio to Cocky, and I went home to Hampstead. I remember that. I remember coming down. The last I saw of him, I did contact Jack Peaker after the war. He didn't wish to talk too much about it. He'd lost a brother during the war, and he spent his life cultivating mushrooms, and he went into the big mushroom market, but he never joined the Bomber Command Association, and I can understand why.
Now, so what happened with your post? I mean, you leave there, and then that's the end of your logbook. What about the rest of your RAF service? I mean,
well, I signed on for another year, and they gave me various jobs. And
what type of postings?
I got posted to a place called Fulbeck, where I did several jobs there, one in the stores, which I said I didn't want to do anymore. I'd like you to know why I signed on for another year.
Tell me, why?
I was offered several opportunities for further education. That was one thing the RAF did. I rejected all of these because I was into photography. I wanted to go into the world of film. My brother was already in it and had served as a photographer during the war, and I wanted to be either alongside him or join with him. And in the event, we both went into the motion picture business, and I enjoyed it. That year gave me the opportunity.
Why?
To study by being in the Air Force still. Advantage of getting study information, which they were very helpful with, and also finding out myself.
And what were you actually doing? I mean, the postings aren't that important either.
I just went to Fulbeck. And at Fulbeck, it was an old bomber station, which gave me a good feeling. Not used, no aircraft flying. And they put me in charge of the police, of all things. So I had my own billet there, and I looked after fascinating period of my life, because everybody in the Air Force seemed to have a bike, and all these bikes were sent to Fulbeck. I was surrounded by thousands and thousands of bikes. And I recall one of the Wellingtons, that one of the boys flew not into Fulbeck but nearby, and he came over and said, "Doug, you flew the Wellingtons." I said, "Yeah." He said, "You can get 18 250 pounders in the Wellington." He said, "Do you know how many worn out tyres you can get in?" I said, "Worn out tyres?" "Yeah," he said. "Bicycle tyres that are removed from bikes," he said, "and there are thousands of them here, aren't there?" I said, "What do you use those for?" He said, "Well, if you open up a tyre, he said, "and you cut it," he said, "it's the exact size of a sole of a boot." And he said, "I'm flying into Germany every day," he said, "and I want to take those tyres over there." I said, "Well, it's better than causing smoke that goes up here, because all the farmers are complaining."
So anything happened while you were there, or was it just you're just studying for a career in photography?
Yeah, which I did. And they were very helpful, the RAF, in the last days. You know, they didn't... They encourage you to stay on and on and on, you know. But
what about your demobilisation? When was that?
I don't remember, actually.
In 1946, then?
Yeah.
And what was the process of demob?
Usual. You went up to Kirkham, and they were very good, friendly. Very much like when you came in, I sensed. The officers and the men, it was a welcoming when you came in, and it was a pretty happy cheerio when you went out. You got your mob suit, there was a bit of a joke, you know, you got all the bits and pieces, and the box was the same, which you discarded very quickly, because that box was a symbol of it's all over. And most of us who went there, we went to Blackpool and had a good time in Blackpool for a few days, which was probably the happiest town in the UK, you know. It was never bombed.
Now, we don't do a lot about... But we get you back into civilian... There's two things about you we want to do. One, get you back into civilian life. The other, do your thing with Bomber Command Association. Now, quickly, what was your career? I mean, your career was in... Just sketch out your career so people can see what happened to you after the war.
Okay. I had made a deep study of photography anyway, book study. I had no personal experience, so I took a job at the Odeon Leicester Square, Odeon Swiss Cottage, as a third assistant projectionist, handling film, projecting film, and living on my gratuity, because they paid very little. I then went and worked for Messrs. Kodak, to see how the film was made, and I worked with them for a long time.
What, in the laboratories?
In their factory at Harrow.
And what were you doing there?
Film coating. And then the film, once it's coated, is split up, and then it's perforated, ready to go into the cine cameras. Then I went to George Humphrey's motion picture laboratory in London, where I worked for four years, in different jobs, and spotting and working on that. And I then became what is known as a lab contact. My job was to see the film coming from the studios into the laboratory, being processed, taking it back to the studios the following day, and seeing it as rushes in the studio. And that was successful. And three of us left the motion picture industry and started up our own motion picture laboratory, which was successful, and we produced medical, religious and educational films. We moved away from the motion picture entertainment area and we came into a rather educational area. And that was successful until somebody approached us and they bought us out. And I retired, and with what I thought was a very successful life behind me in the film business, not always successful, contrary to belief, but very badly paid, you know. But I enjoyed it. And then I came into
now, hang on. Had your wartime experiences had any physical or mental effect on you, good or bad? Not saying, not prejudicing you, physically, mentally, in any way, good or bad?
Physically, I became almost a left hand of what I did. I was right-handed, I write right-handed, and strangely enough, I played tennis right-handed. Everything else became left-handed, golf, cricket. And that was because of this, which I got a war.
Your arm injury.
I got a war pension for that.
How much? A disability pension?
Yes, yeah.
And how much of a pension? Was it adequate?
Well, so it started off about £20 a week, I think, and now it's about 35. You know, it goes up with, but deeply appreciated. Others, you know, were more badly injured than me. But
any mental effects?
No.
You had, you know, it's quite stressful flying those wartime missions, but any mental effects?
None, no.
Now, let's take us through take us through your work with Bomber Command Association, because you're very prominent in that. Tell me what it is you do and what's it, why it's so important to you and others.
Okay, I'll nip back just a second, because when it finished in the film business, I had retired. I said I'd retired, and I found a misery of playing golf with three other people who didn't like me and I didn't like them. Years and years and years. The honour of a captaincy in the golf club made it all the worse, because that's all I ever thought about, all I ever did. And I thought, this is not for me. And one day I went to an air show just to photograph the American B-17 that had got airborne. And I met some chaps who were trying to revive a Bomber Command Association. And I saw that they had no idea of how to go about it, not even getting the right people to be involved or getting the how to finance it, etc. And that was something like 20 years ago, even to last week, as I told you, Peter. I've been doing this for 20 years with a grand group of chaps who needed something like this. They needed to hang on to something. And it's been good, and we've...
So what role did you take? What are you? Are you
the secretary.
Secretary.
Secretary, yeah. But we went right to the top, and we got Sir Michael Beetham, Marshal of the Royal Air Force, who came along. And most presidents remain on the top of a piece of headed paper. Not so in his case. He's been a marvel, great help to us. He got us here.
Listen, now here's the RAF Museum. We're here. This is where the interview's taking place.
Yeah.
Our old enemies, so to speak, at the War Museum. But, and they've been fantastic. Tell me what they've done for you, because they have been very good to you.
Well, they've given us grace and favour, accommodation. And this is the power for the Bomber Command Association. Most associations are running in with British legions, tops of pubs, private houses. Here we're in the kingpin for the Bomber Hall. And part of our constitution is that we support it, and we have supported it in the tube of many thousands of pounds, tens of thousands of pounds.
Now, what does your role as secretary entail? Because you work almost full-time here and have done for 20 years. What do you do? And how much time do you spend on it?
Well, you spend all your time here. It's computerised, and you help and aid the members. You fundraise. You attend meetings. You attend and accept the honours that are given, and we've had the honour of being invited by our patron, the late Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, where we had a personal time with her in Clarence House. We have the advantage of the most marvellous ceremony in St Paul's Cathedral, where the Lancaster flew over and honoured us there, and by the City of London. And these honours have come from the membership. The membership have gathered together, and they are all good fundraisers. They will lecture in schools with the right stories, the right things.
How many members do you have? About
6,000.
All actual Bomber Command crew, or
and ground crew.
And ground crew.
Oh yes.
And does it include associate members? That?
Oh yes. That's very few. I would say out of the, you've probably got about 150 social members. And they are mostly authors, editors, commentators who need an access here, and have given us a lot of help. You know, I mean, they're not just coming into what they can get out of it. They've given us a lot. You know, I mean, particularly the publishers and the authors. We have a book signing. You know, where you can walk away from Duxford with a book signing, courtesy of the Imperial War Museum, and we end up with £2,000 or £3,000 just for helping sign books. You know, so. You know, the associates are a great help to us. Yeah.
And what about the hours you work? I mean, what are the office hours you keep here? I mean, is it 9 till 5 or what is it? I mean,
it's like bomber command, but you work round the clock. If you work nights, if you have something going on at night, you work at night. I like to get in here very early for a personal reason. That is, I don't like sitting in traffic. If I get here at 7:30 in the morning and I can leave at 4:30, that suits me.
So it's a full working day with a slightly flexible hours for you to suit you.
Yeah.
And you've been doing this day in and out, because you work weekends as well, don't you? Not so much now, I think. But
no, when the air shows were on, we would work weekends as well. And of course, this is the time for reunions, the weekends, and Sundays, the Sunday memorial service, you know.
Is there a problem? We're interested in veteran association. Is there a problem as, I mean, your Bomber Command is rooted in the Second World War. And by definition, your membership is aging, and aging fast now, in the sense that everyone's over 80, really.
Yeah. Up to 67, see, Bomber Command brought in the V-Force.
But most of your members, from
earlier. They are, yeah.
Is there a problem with an aging membership?
Well, as it's aged, I've aged with it, so I don't notice this. I've been, as far as we're concerned, you've got these 80-year-olds who are running around like 50-year-olds, and of course there are a lot of 50-year-olds who are dead already. You know, this is one of the problems. You can never tell. But I have a group of chaps I could go to tomorrow, and they would go anywhere in the world, speak to classes, top level or anything. They are the prime.
So cream. At the moment you're not suffering from it at all?
No.
Do you see yourself as having a role defending the reputation of Bomber Command? Because, you know, there was a fad for attacking Bomber Command and Arthur Harris. Do you see it as a role of defending as well?
Not so much a role of defence, of getting the true facts to everybody. And once they read the facts of what happened, you don't need to defend anything. There's no need to defend. I mean, there's no shame of trying to defend yourself. Okay.
Thank you very much.
Can I just say one thing? That I've lived this life, and I look back, and you look at the Royal Navy, His Majesty's Navy, the Army, the units, all of them went to war. If you went to war at sea in those buckets, the dreadful conditions they lived in, the type of warfare was pretty awful. And when they came on leave, they'd end up at Gosport, Portsmouth, some Plymouth, with thousands of other sailors. Then you've got the army boy. He's in a barracks somewhere, tucked away in Wiltshire, wherever, even Scotland. The next thing you have, he goes into battle, and he doesn't come out until that echelon is relieved. Meanwhile, he's sleeping in a ditch. He's sleeping in a hotel that's been blasted. He's sleeping in a bivouac. He sleeps in where he can, in a field or under tent. And then you come to the flyer, the Bomber Command. He goes into action. He comes out of it. He comes back into the beauty of the English countryside. He comes back into normality. The moment that four and a half hours after he's been into battle, he has this with a country pub, maybe a girlfriend, who knows. Everything that you can have in life is there for him every night. That is the difference I felt when you go to war, that warfare in World War II struck so different with the air crews and the ground crews who were stationed in the heart of the English countryside in Anglia, Lincolnshire, Yorkshire, the little villages, always near a little village, always at little pubs, always something else. not with the Navy, the Army. We had a cushy time of it, as long as you lived.
I think that's a good way to end. Thank you very much.